method of attack suggested itself. I closed my eyes and established contact with Dara, mind to mind. "How far are you from Fort Destiny?" I asked her. "I'm here now, and I think there's an opportunity for the Skyriders. We're roosting on a hilltop about 3 miles to the southeast," she replied. "We've been here since dawn. Waiting for orders?" she added pointedly. "Here are some orders, then. I've got a line of enshadowed sorcerers assailing the keep from the south," I explained. "They're about halfway between the infantry and the skirmishers. I'll mark the line with smoke," I decided, as it was too bright for mage lights to be easily seen. "I need both wings to charge that line from the air and make things difficult for them. They're preparing something nasty, and I want to disrupt their concentration." "We can do that," she agreed. "How are the winds?" "Insight tells me that they're coming from the northwest, but nothing robust." "We'll be there in 20 minutes, she promised. "We have our mission," I announced when my eyes opened. "In 15 minutes, we need to produce a cloud of smoke at each end of that line. In 20 minutes, we need to be prepared to attack and mop up before the rest of their army realizes what's happening and reinforces them." A particularly loud report echoed across the battlefield, as some powerful spell was launched against the castle. A heartbeat later, one of the turrets on the wall below erupted in green explosive fire. "Those foul sorcerers will regret the day they dared to contend with the wizards of the Mage Law," Caswallon declared, drawing his mage blade dramatically. "Lead on, Count Minolin, and let the bodies pile in our wake."
"A stealthy approach, I assume, and as quietly as possible? 2 on each end and 2 in the middle?"
Astaroth asked me, curious. "Why exclude anyone?" the Iron Band War Mage asked. "I've some fellows who would be well suited to such a fight. We've been crossing wands with the Gavanni for years now. It would be an honor to follow you into the field," he assured us. In just a few minutes, he was able to assemble 5 other Iron Band War Magi who were prepared for such a stealthy sortie. I directed Astaroth and Caswallon to make for the western end of the line, and Landric and Tamanil to the east. I led Boroso and the Iron Band's men toward the center. Moving across an active battlefield during broad daylight is tricky business. War magic makes it easier, but there's always the possibility that you'll attract attention before you're ready for it. We passed our own scouts and skirmishers, brave men hiding behind boulders or miniature redoubts with bows and crossbows, ready to engage any goblin bold enough to approach the walls. There were still a fair number of powerful spells in the field around the castle, I noted, as we picked our way slowly but steadily across the rocky expanse of scrub below the moat. Any sudden charge against the walls would get ugly if they weren't dismantled first. The archers overhead promised to make that process deadly. I kept an eye on the positions from where Insight insisted the enshadowed sorcerers were fighting. I spotted 2 of them in person once we got closer. The enshadowed were clustered in knots of 2 or 3, behind trees or rocks, as they cast their enchantments. Most had a few Gavanni attendants or bodyguards nearby. The enshadowed were wearing their ancient battle forms, making them tall and spindly compared to the Terra Alon. Their armor, too, was in the ancient style, and they wielded staffs, wands and other devices I wasn't familiar with. Each had a long-bladed, short-hafted spear near at hand, and many had bows. We weren't spotted. Thankfully, they were so intent on assaulting the Humani castle in front of them that they did not suspect a Humani sortie against them. "We're in possession," Astaroth notified me in a few moments. "Let me know when to cast the spell." I was just following Boroso's lead toward a rocky outcropping that gave us some cover against the enshadowed, who was about 300 yards away. The Iron Band's men trailed behind me, wands and swords in hand, cautiously following in my very footsteps to avoid detection. "We're nearly ready," I reported back. "Go ahead and begin." Just as we arrived behind the outcropping, a plume of dark black smoke began to rise to our left. It seemed pretty innocuous, considering all of the other smoke and dust getting kicked up, but with a little magical help it was soon distinctive. A moment later, a second column arose on our right flank. "We've arrived at our end," Landric told me, mind to mind, a moment later. "How long do we have?"
"Moments," I promised. "As soon as you see feathers, prepare to go in, and as soon as the dust settles from their attack, it's your turn."
I paused to take a sip from my water skin and catch my breath. Sneaking around is hard work. But then I caught a glimpse of a shadow appearing above the eastern ridge, and the battle was on. There was no rumble of hoofs or cry of horns as the charge came from the air. Indeed, there was no warning as one skyrider after another swept in over the heads of our foes and began delivering mayhem from the skies. The great hawks didn't announce themselves with their war cries until the attack was well underway. Skybolts, crossbow quarrels, alchemical bombs and offensive magic fell in an uneven rain along the line between the two columns of smoke. The protective spells of the Enshadowed were designed to ward off danger from the castle, not the clouds. As each successive wing of giant falcons loosed its attack on the foe, there was a confused tangle of shocked and surprised Enshadowed. Their carefully prepared spells started to go awry. Dara's wing slashed up the enemy below from high above. Natia's wing got more personal. Just as the surviving sorcerers began to get to their feet, the Vanadori Skyriders swooped in close and plucked the Enshadowed from their nests like they were a bunch of young rabbits. The razor-sharp steel spurs ripped limbs off, eviscerated or decapitated as they struck. Those who weren't torn asunder by Iltadine steel were returned to the ground from a few hundred feet in the air. When the last bird passed by, I commanded a charge against the two surviving Enshadowed spellcasters that remained in the center of the line. Barroso boldly crossed the scrublands at a sprint, belying his large size with his speed as he ploughed into the little redoubt that sheltered his target, chin first. I went toward the other one insight told me was still breathing, a brace of iron-band war magi following me. It was a quick fight. The Alka Alon had been wounded by a well-placed skybolt in his upper thigh, and his face was still smouldering from one of the incendiary blasts from above. Nonetheless, he scrambled for his spear with one hand when he saw us approach, and his Gavani bodyguard leapt to his defense, only to fall to a blast from one of my comrades. I drew twilight and ended the sorcerer's struggle with a deadly spell of my own. "My foe is dead," Barroso reported, mind to mind, a few moments later. "He put up a mighty struggle, though. Whatever he was working on was ruined, and he was enraged. I've never seen an Alka Alon so angered," he added. "The Enshadowed tend to be more reactionary than most," I advised, "but be cautious of their gear. We don't know what a tithe of it does." My own victim was surrounded by what I assumed were the tools of his trade. A collection of slender wands no bigger than reeds was stuffed in a kind of short quiver, and a basket containing little clay pots and clods of what looked like dirt was open, as if he'd been using them as ammunition. In addition to the spear he died with in his hands, there was a long, curved knife at his belt, nearly as long as an infantry sword. "Are those magical blades, my lord?" asked one of the bandsmen. "I would be shocked if they were not," I nodded. "The Enshadowed employ the Dradrian, just as we do. But it is certainly worthy of further study, as is his store of whatever they are. This is the real prize, however," I said, plucking a smooth green pebble from near the corpse with my glove. "Irionite, pure and polished, Alka Alon style," I added, as I held it up to the sun. "After I cleanse it, I'll raise one of you fellows to high mage," I promised. That made them all pay a little closer attention. "I suppose your spears and spells don't matter much when you're not more than a mouse to them glorious birds," said another reverently. "Any chance we can get a few of them for the band, my lord?" "The falcons require training, magic, and a rider who doesn't weigh much more than 100 pounds, I advised. "That's why more than half their riders are maidens. They're also devilishly expensive to feed in this form." "That's a pity," sighed the war mage, as his fellows joined us. "They'd make patrolling a damn sight easier. Never saw them fight before, either. And they're so pretty," he added, scanning the skies for any further signs of the birds. "If you're that interested, the Muse has need of wizards on the ground to support their efforts in the skies," I informed him as I sheathed twilight and placed the witchstone carefully into a pouch. "I think we're done here. Let's head back to the castle," I ordered. That brought a look of confusion to the man's face. "My lord, we're within striking distance of their advance force," he said urgently, pointing toward the Gavani infantry rushing up the hill toward us. "That was not why I led this sortie," I dismissed after I regarded the distant reinforcements.
The goal was to deprive them of as much of their magical core as possible and disrupt their arcane operations. We accomplished that. Whatever spell they were planning is ruined now. We need not fight the whole battle. The Iron Band's men looked at the goblins skeptically and looked back at me beseechingly.
My lord, Count,
their leader implored, you cannot strike such a blow against them and just leave. I counted upon their swift response to the attack, I said calmly, as we walked back toward the outcropping. They are pouring their infantry into the fray without thought, like ants stirred up with a stick. Your own presence attracts them. They will advance up this hill until they reach the moat, which is well within bowshot. But they will do so as an unruly mob, not a disciplined force. They will not be able to adequately defend against what comes next. And what is that, my lord? He asked, curious but anxious. There were a lot of goblins suddenly rushing up the hill. The Sky Riders are adept at these operations, I explained as we walked. They do not make a journey in support of an action unless they are willing to commit themselves. I figure in just a few more moments, I said, finally hearing the screech of a giant falcon. Sky Captains Dara and Natia will have completed their maneuver and led their birds back overhead from the south, thus catching the infantry on the move, unprepared and unwarded by what's left of the enemy's magical core. As if in fulfillment of my prediction, the sound of aerial attack began behind and above me as the giant falcons returned to the field, in force. This time, Natia's wings flew high above, while Dara's riders went low and slashed at the leaders of the charge, plucking them off the hillside like rats and peppering the foe with skybolts and offensive magic. When they were clear of the battle, Natia's unit unleashed the hundreds of cabbage-sized rocks from their hoxter pockets overhead. That shredded the ragged advance with rain of heavy stones, an unexpected avalanche from the sky. Where they did not have an immediate effect, when they landed, they bounced down the steep hillside into the oncoming Gavani troops like deadly hail. A final volley of incendiary devices and irritating magical constructs further complicated matters. A field of magically animated enchantments arose like mushrooms across the hillside and began attacking the besieging force. They weren't particularly large in most cases, with some as small as a milking stool, but they hampered the Gavani advance significantly. It's hard to conduct a charge when faced with the sudden appearance of a company of mindless, belligerent milking stools. The Sky Riders' attack was punishing, but it didn't halt the advance. Deprived of most of their magical core, the goblin commanders resorted to the traditional. They sent their troops against the defenses of Fort Destiny in a great, screaming mass. We hurried in front of the ragged advance, following the hidden skirmishers who were withdrawing through a postern door. By the time we were inside the castle and again mounting the battlements where the commander awaited us, the archers were already loosing shaft after shaft against the approaching goblins. That went better than I expected, I informed Sir Sastan. The Sky Riders adeptly destroyed the line of sorcerers. My men and I merely mopped up the survivors. It was impressive, Count Minilan, he agreed as he peered out over the wall. They were magnificent in flight, like a glimpse of some old legend. And effective, I nodded. Shakathet's lieutenant likely had the best of his magi in that line. The few that remain in his camp are probably inconsequential. The Sky Riders? My lord, Tamanio said suddenly, examine the scene with your mage sight. I'd only had a brief acquaintance with the Terra Alon warrior, but his urgency was unmistakable and compelling. I quickly turned back to the battlefield and called on mage sight. A moment later I summoned insight back to my hand, and my baculus quickly made more sense of what my eyes were seeing. There were tendrils of arcane energy emerging from near the command tent, toward the rear of the enemy encampment, tendrils that stretched out toward the castle. Indeed, they were affixed to a spot above and behind us, near the center of the wall of the Great Keep. The energy involved was not great, but it was persistent, pushing through our wards with far more subtlety than we were used to from Gavani war magic. This was clearly an Alka Alon spell. Disrupt that, I snapped to my fellows, who were already drawing their witch stones and preparing. I don't know what it is, but I don't like it. What is it? Demanded Sastan, alarmed. A spell, Astaroth informed him, with a note of sarcasm in his voice. An Alka Alon spell, my lord, Tamanio explained, as he drew power from his own witchstone.
Not a song spell, but an old sorcery from the ancient wars.
Well, what does it do? He asked anxiously. How do you stop it?
I know not the answer to either question, my lord, Tamanio said apologetically. It could be any number of things, but it is latched onto your castle and does not bode well.
It's a telluric wave, men,
Astoral announced a moment later. My lord, I beg you to evacuate the keep as quickly as possible. Wide-eyed, the commander began shouting orders to his aides.
Earth energy?
Landrick asked suspiciously.
Do they mean to disintegrate the keep? Let me try a deflection.
He raised his baculus and began tuning the power he'd gathered into a counterspell.
That's not the form I'd use for disintegration, Astoral said, shaking his head.
Those sorcerers they had in advanced positions. They were ranging the castle and planting hooks while they were throwing rocks, he decided. Enough hooks to build up the potential area of action to bypass our wards. At a specific target, he concluded.
Defensive magic is not my strength, Caswallon said through clenched teeth, but I will gladly add my spellwork to the effort. Begone, you harbinger of destruction, he shouted at the empty wall above us.
Whatever spell he threw did nothing that insight could determine, or perhaps he just figured the force of his will and charisma alone would cow the thaumaturgical construct into submission. With Caswallon, either possibility was valid.
It's not working,
Barroso complained, as his counterspell failed to move or dissipate the energy stream. There is no purchase within the waveform. I've never faced battle sorcery from the Alka Alon before.
Not many have, I murmured.
Try a restrictive activator. Maybe you can retard the intent to initiate, I suggested. I was directing a coercive stream of power at the target myself, upon Insight's recommendation. If we couldn't move the position of the hook, perhaps we could limit the area of effect. Perhaps if I'd been using a normal shard of Irionite, it wouldn't have had much chance. But with the immense power within the Major Sphere, I was able to surround the target with an impressive amount of power. For another minute or two, each of us tried to force the steadily growing shaft of invisible energy from the side of the keep. The most we could manage was to move it a few feet to the right and bind the radius of the beam to as small a location as possible. The problem was, we didn't know if that was going to help in the slightest, and that was disturbing.
Perhaps we should focus instead on the origin of the spell instead of its destination, Astoral suggested, as his third counterspell failed.
I think we... Before he could finish the sentence, an enormous wave of energy burst from the enemy camp, riding along the lines of power they'd established with little regard to our efforts to stop, deflect it, or even slow its pace. For an instant, every hair stood on end, and time seemed frozen. Then, with an ear-splitting crack, the keep above split asunder. It wasn't an explosion. We later figured out that a column of magical force, defined by the spell, took everything within its bounds and instantly turned it 90 degrees around its axis. That doesn't sound too bad in theory. Going from vertical to horizontal might shake you up, but it wasn't inherently lethal. But if you did that to a section of masonry and timber within the complexities of a carefully engineered structure, the result was devastating. Support columns were suddenly gone. Floors and ceilings lost key parts of their structure. Gaping holes suddenly opened up above or below or both. Men caught within the spell were bashed to death or torn asunder by the torsion field. Walls collapsed, the roof fell in, and the great cistern at the top of the keep burst spectacularly to add to the chaos. Nor was the keep the only damage. Due to the angle of the sorcerer's attack, a portion of the gatehouse and a goodly section of the curtain wall were also affected. In an instant, our foes had pierced our defences and deprived us from using the strongest structure in the castle, as well as killing hundreds in the ensuing collapse. Cries of alarm and horns of warning sounded in the aftermath once our ears recovered from the sound of the great crash. A massive column of dust arose from the cleft in the keep. Fully a third of it was gone.
By the reeky feet of the sow goddess!
Caswallon exclaimed in horror as we watched the centre of the building implode on itself.
That's Alka Alon magic?
Barroso asked out loud as he stared at the damage, aghast.
I thought they just did trees and nature and such. That looks like Duin the Destroyer took a gigantic dump on that keep. To answer the horn calls from the keep, a note from the deep brassy horns the Gavani used sounded behind us. The infantry, who had been rushing uphill to give us chase, howled in answer before they charged at the sudden breach in the wall. They made up as much distance as they could while the archers opposing them were stunned by the spell's destructive effects. In an instant, a dozen were climbing the rubble from the wall while others braved the moat, eager to join them as a much larger force began marching up the hill behind them.
"That's Alka Alon battle sorcery," nodded Tamanil gravely.
"Had you not constrained it, Count Minolin, that spell would have torn the entire top off of that cape."
"We just aren't used to that kind of magic," complained Landrick bitterly. "We don't know how to counter it, but they are certainly learning how to counter ours.
Humani magic, even war magic, is simple and derivative compared to the sophistication of ours," Tamanil said, without judgment. "Once they learned it, it would be easy enough to counter your defences. It was wise of you to try to evacuate the keep," he added to Astaral.
"We still lost scores," Landrick said, shaking his head, "because apparently the craft I've devoted my life to is akin to a child's toy compared to our foes."
"Can we at least counterattack?" pleaded Buroso.
His jutting jaw was thrust out in righteous anger.
"Aye, Caswallon, volunteer to lead such a mission of retribution," the big war mage said, as he looked out toward the enemy's camp. "I will rend such a trail of carnage through their ranks that—"
"No," I objected sharply. "Caswallon, Buroso, and Tamanil, head for the breach in the wall and help the Iron Bandsmen hold it," I ordered. "Astaral and Landrick, get back to the keep and see who you can save, and then start evacuating everyone to Megalyn through the ways. Start with the wounded," I advised.
"Evacuate, my lord?"
Buroso asked, confused.
"I am only newly acquainted with the Alcan ways, but I was educated that only a few men could be thus transported without grave danger."
"We have high magi here who can take a few at a time," I explained.
"And there are ways to augment that," Tamanil agreed.
"I can summon a few more Terra Alon. With effort, we can bring most of them through in a few hours."
"But to abandon our post, my lord,"
Buroso continued, his chin waving about dangerously.
"I am not in favor of that."
"I mislike this cause," Sastan said, returning from reviewing the ruined keep. "It smacks of defeat."
"There is no glory in a hopeless death if you refuse the path of retreat the gods have granted you,"
Caswallon said, in a rare display of wisdom.
"We can take our vengeance another day."
I took a long look up at the ruined keep, and then down at the half-destroyed wall below.
"This is a defeat," I pronounced. "With one shot, they ruined the refuge and spoiled the outer defences. We could fight and die to the last man, but for what? We'll put up the best defence we can while we get everyone clear, but in the end, this battle is lost. Those men will be more valuable defending Megalyn Castle than dying pointlessly here." I continued to give orders and suggestions to Sastan for a few moments as the goblin army rushed toward the breach in the wall. My men quickly took their leave and went to their tasks, though Astaral lingered behind a moment.
"So, are you going to help with the wounded, or are you defending the breach?" he asked, curious.
"Neither," I said, sending Insight back to its huckster pocket. I summoned my battle staff, Blizzard, instead. The thick weirwood and steel construction felt comfortably heavy in my hands, and the ancient, belligerent enneagram within woke up. I directed it to connect with the megalith, floating over my shoulder. "We may not have been prepared to contend with Alka Alon sorcery, and that cost us this battle. To delay the inevitable, I think it's time I showed our foes some magic with which they are unfamiliar." With that, I activated the sympathy stone in Blizzard's ornate head, the one connected to the snowflake in Sevendor. The megalith's core began pulsating in time with the energy coming through the stone. Astaral raised his eyebrows in surprise.
"Something new you cooked up?"
It occurred to me that Astaral had not been told about the powerful quasi-Malapar I had back in Sevendor, nor about its innate connection with the megalith.
"Something old," I corrected. "Impossibly old. Impossibly powerful. And I'm suddenly very curious just what it can do."
Chapter 20. The Wrath of the Spellmonger. "Take heed of the wrath of the wizards, for it is furious when wise," and terrible to behold when unwise. Magelor Folksang, from the collection of Janik the Rish. I was upset. I'd come to Fort Destiny to preserve it, and I was watching it be destroyed. The Iron Band's men were defending their walls valiantly, standing their ground atop the pile of rubble the spell had produced. Shieldmen and pikemen were keeping the first attackers at bay, while archers from all over the castle fired against the goblins. Yet the Gavanni infantry, who swarmed against them, were just as determined. A mixture of breeds and varieties of Gavanni pushed up the hill and into the breach with resolve, stopping to fire crossbows or hurl spears or grappling hooks against us. When they reached the hole in the wall, they redoubled their ferocity and attacked with club and sword, tooth and claw. Behind the vanguard flowed a long, angry river of Gavanni, punctuated by trolls, a few Draugen and other foul folk. I could tell at once that they were uniting in the entrained consensus that the Alon could manage. They began to march as one, all of them part of the same great organism whose sole purpose was to tear down the castle. Only the siege worms and the scattered undead did not share in the consensus, I noted. I walked down to the breach. Watching my war madge, I joined the defence. Tamaniel was using his wands and blade with elegant efficiency, employing the Humani-style war magic he'd learned. Borasso began heaving powerful spells the moment he arrived at the breach. His mage blade flung deadly bolts of force with precision as he sought out where he was needed the most. Caswallon was all over the place. As annoying as he can be, the man can fight, and he proved himself again and again in the few moments I saw him in action on the wall. He used war magic liberally to speed his attacks and leapt from one fight to another. He used an array of weapons instead of favoring one in this instance, and he howled pompous-sounding insults at the foe the entire time. The breach would be held, I could see, for a time at least, but not forever. Not against the mass of soldiery that it faced. 2,000 men in a crippled castle would not prevail without some intervention. I was to be that intervention. I'd come to Fort Destiny to preserve it. Failing that, I would avenge it. I found a place atop the left-hand gatehouse, the one that hadn't been damaged in the spell. While archers swirled madly about me, sniping at the attacking Gavanni from the heights, I moved calmly and determinedly to a spot at the corner of the square tower where I might oversee the battle and select my targets. It was near enough the breach for me to attend to that, and it loomed over the steep approach that our foes had to climb. An excellent spot for war magic. Blizzard felt warm in my hand as I began selecting spells and preparing my defences. I could not help recalling the siege of Beauval Castle, and the first time I faced a sea of furry black faces that wanted nothing more in life but to slay me. The difference was that there were far fewer facing me this time, and I was far better armed and prepared for the fight. This time I had sophisticated magic, not a few war magic spells and my stock of domestic spellmonger enchantments. This time I had Blizzard, and I had the Megalith. This time I had well-armed, experienced soldiers around me, not desperate peasants and a handful of mercenaries. This time, despite the ruined keep behind me, I had confidence in what I was about to do. When I was ready, I took a deep breath and allowed the noise and tumult of battle to fade from my notice. I began channeling power from the megalith like a thirsty horse drinking at the trough. I felt it flow through my mind and redirected it to the battery of spells Blizzard laid out before me like a quiver full of deadly arrows. Everything went still as I began. A powerful, directed blast of concussive force blew a dozen Gavanni from the face of the wall in a flash. A second spoiled the charge of another company of hobgoblins that promised to overwhelm the defenders. That allowed the Iron Bandsmen time to get more reinforcements atop the rubble, where Caswallon and Borosso were making a stand and rallying the troops. Caswallon began whooping and chanting something about the spellmonger, but I was too busy to pay much attention. I was just getting warmed up. There was a steady stream of Gavanni and trolls trudging up the road against us. I complicated their approach with a volley of arcane blasts, varying the type and power of each to avoid counterspells. Fire and lightning followed implosive and explosive shells. It was a lavish display of power and delivered more quickly than I could have done on my own,
but that's why wizards practice enchantment. Blizzard and the megalith had the fundamentals for those workings already within them. I merely had to power and direct them. One by one, my arcane attacks tore holes in the advance. Trolls fell howling in pain among the smaller goblins, doing as much damage in their painful wrath as my spells. Eldritch fire scorched and burned my hairy enemies with relentless ferocity, spreading out over bare and rocky ground as if it was packed with tinder. Gouts of arcane power erupted down the road in a festive variety of destruction. The determined advance was slowed, and then halted, as my spellwork created a dozen bottlenecks along the route. The howls of agony and fear added to the din in the background, the kind of professional applause any war mage likes to hear. The siege worms, lining up behind the infantry, were tightly packed for the terrain, and their wranglers were already having a difficult time keeping them in line. They were massive beasts, some more than 40 feet long, and each a living siege engine. Their great nose horns were plated with iron and waved menacingly behind and above the Ghavani troops. The way was narrow enough to require them to advance one at a time. Should they make the top of the slope and face the castle gates, the tower I was on would be shredded in minutes by their massive horns and their terrible claws. Once within the walls, the carnivorous creatures would add their powerful jaws and teeth to the fray, while the archers in the little wooden castles on their backs would slay scores of iron bandsmen. I couldn't have that, could I? Tyndall and Rondol had discovered the effectiveness of sonic attacks on the creatures when they'd first been deployed in Gilmora a few years ago. Although the enshadowed sorcerers had prepared the siege worms against such attacks with an impressive layer of defensive spells, I used Blizzard to shred them apart with surprising ease. Then I cast the attack that Rondol had perfected against the little ears of the great beast and pumped it with far more energy than had ever been attempted before. The effect was gratifying, as I watched it play out with mage sight. The half-dozen beasts were simultaneously assaulted with the powerful, pulsating sound. Though it was mostly subsonic, it was powerful enough that even the handlers of the great worms clapped their hands over their ears and fell to their knees with the force of the spell. The worms began tossing their heads angrily and straining against the chains and ropes that held and directed them. Great howls of outrage and panic made the gigantic creature's panic obvious to everyone nearby, and the wise Ghavani ran before they were trampled. The first worm to break from its bonds charged blindly into one of the large mangonels in their artillery, knocking it asunder in a panic with its 6 powerful claws as it sought to escape the relentless noise. That drew my attention to the battery of catapults and other engines Shakathet had sent to destroy Fort Destiny. They were far more advanced and elegant than the first Ghavani-designed engines in the war. The Enshadowed understood engineering better than the goblins did, and the result was both more powerful and more accurate than earlier examples. They'd been hurling rocks and less savory missiles against the castle since the army first arrived, and they had proven how much more deadly they were in that brief time. A great battering ram at the front of the line promised to be large enough to batter the castle gates to bits if brought to bear. The artillery was warded tightly against magic. We had targeted the expensive, invaluable machines frequently in our wars, and Shakathet had at least paid attention to that. A thick cloud of arcane power protected the catapults and mangonels from most of our common attacks, and the mixture of Ghavani, shamanic magic, and enshadowed sorceries made the protective canopy particularly forbidding. Only the command tent at the rear of the encampment was better defended against magical attack. I smiled to myself. This was almost a challenge. At my direction, Blizzard began discerning the fundamental elements of the defences. The paraclete within the battlestaff was aggressive and belligerent, as eager to attack as it had been when it was a predator in the ocean 1,000,000 years ago. Though it lacked the jaws or claws or whatever it had been armed with in its first life, it flexed the innate spellwork incorporated into its enchantment as if it was about to pounce on vulnerable prey. There was a feral thrill extended through my rapport with my weapon that added a delicious anticipation for what was about to happen. Blizzard's intelligence puzzled out how best to reduce the defensive spells and began to tear away at them. Wardings that would have taken a cenacle of war magi to disarm were shredded in seconds.
Blizzard gleefully dismantled layer after layer of defensive spellwork. Then the real fun came. I allowed my battle staff complete liberty in how it wanted to proceed, once I convinced it what the targets were. With just a little guidance, Blizzard pulled power from the limitless font of the megalith and began tearing into the siege engines and their crews. Fields of power sprang up around and within them, either desiccating the wood, shattering it, or heating it until it burst into flame. Where the fields overlapped, the destruction was instant and complete. The complex constructions fell apart or were blown asunder as the powerful mechanical forces, held in place by strong wood and iron, released their tension in an explosive fashion. The pointed head of the battering ram rusted into ruinous decay, and the great log split into sections like firewood. The artillerymen were not spared. The crowd of Givani that had been tending the engines bore a ferocious attack of spinning magical force that tore through their bodies like shrapnel. Waves of energy sheared away their flesh, or abraded their skin, or rotted their bones within their bodies as Blizzard savaged them. When it was done, the row of catapults was a hulking ruin, and those who tended the machines were scattered and dying. The amount of power I was channeling was tremendous. I could feel everything around me fade from notice as I turned my attention to the last, most important target, the command tent. The defenses surrounding the dark canopy were even stronger than those that had protected the artillery. Here, I knew, was where the devastating spell that had crippled the castle originated. The tangled knot of arcane energy that surrounded the site pulsed in mage sight, with strands of power and intersecting fields of force surging around it. Many were to prohibit spying or scrying, I guessed, but many more had the spiky aspect that suggested common means of attack would be diminished or countered. A ring of debris from the damaged artillery was settling around it, testament to the potency of the spells. It was certainly meant to be foreboding. Blizzard saw it as a tasty snack once I redirected its attention to the dark pavilion. The defenses were potent, but passive. My Paraclete was actively contesting the wards at every turn, undermining the thaumaturgical structure of the shielding spells, or just overwhelming them with naked force. Like an angry dog attacking a rodent, Blizzard crackled with power, and the air around me sparked with the residual energy. I didn't notice at the time, but most of the archers on the tower had backed away from me. My own rising anger began fueling the effort. I tried to be dispassionate in battle, as old Jürgen Dole had constantly emphasized in our war magic training. Anger undermines control, the legendary war mage had taught, but there comes a point where your baser emotions are required in order to sustain a magical effort. I was pushing more power through my mind than most wizards could stand. My body was exhausted with the effort already. Dispassionate will and mental discipline will only take you so far, however, and I could feel the beginnings of fatigue setting in. So I got angry and used that anger to fight it. Anger at the incursion into my beautiful lands. Anger at the cruel horrors inflicted on a vulnerable people. Anger at the relentless contests and the endless scheming against me. Anger at the hatred my enemies were inflicting, a hatred that had the potential to consume the entire world. Blizzard responded with renewed vigor. To my surprise, the megalith floated near to my face and seemed to join in my rage. I could feel the rapport strengthen between my two artifacts and my magical attention. In a moment, the three of us were entrained, and with the handmaiden's attention and support, I felt new strength course through me. Sustained by my anger, a fountain of energy flowed to fuel Blizzard's withering attack on their defensive wards, and one by one they were failing, despite the renewed efforts of the sorcerers within. They were made proof against mere war magic. They fell like wheat against the wrath of the spellmonger. "Burn!" I snarled as I thrust Blizzard toward the tent, nearly a quarter mile away. "Burn, you undead bastards, and all of your works turn to dust!" Whatever fatigue I'd felt was overcome by the magical entrainment. There was no pain nor pleasure, strength nor weakness in me for an instant, just the overwhelming rage I felt, concentrated into one formless spell. When the last of the defenses broke, Blizzard projected a punishing howl of energy against the target and, quite unexpectedly, The handmaiden within the megalith opened the connection it had to the snowflake, away in Sevendor, and borrowed the raw power of the Malapar to add to the assault. The sky seemed to change colour as the fabric of reality appeared to ripple. A crack of thunderous noise enwrapped with the hissing of tortured matter made the land itself shudder, and everyone in the vicinity, friend and foe alike, looked up, startled, at the arcane blaze that the spellmonger was projecting.
"Burn!"
I shouted at my distant foes. Perhaps it was Caswellan's presence that inspired me, or merely the need to voice my anger, but I shouted until my lungs hurt and my throat ached.
"Burn in the fires of creation, you unholy bastards! Burn in retribution for your crimes! Burn to ashes for your trespass on this land! Burn!"
I howled as the light and noise rushed to a crescendo. Whatever was in that tent was obliterated by the force, for it was no mere spell. With the handmaiden's help and Blizzard's feral nature to guide me, the power that emerged from my attack was unordered and raw. Not since Greenflower had I seen such a thing. With that sobering realization, I eased my fury and observed the result. The area that had once contained the command tent was a whirling crater of dust and plasma as the waves of energy washed over it. Nothing lived within that arcane maelstrom. No undead stirred from it either. The destructive force and withering power smashed all within the field into shreds. A band of magical turbulence lashed out in a broad arc around it, further destroying the proximate elements of the enemy army. A pulsing white light, with flashes of green, consumed the region, as if it was a visible manifestation of my anger, which I suppose it was. A dispassionate attitude is, indeed, excellent for control, I noted as the stream waned. But there were times when you needed to lose control to accomplish the objective. The white flame that consumed the enemy's rear would not have existed had my anger not brought it to life. I do not know what exactly the energy was, but the snowflake's endless power had provided a harsh reply to the temerity of the enshadowed. Their sorcery had proven no better defense against it than if they'd been Gavani shamans. I let Blizzard slip to the ground as the stream of power died, my arms feeling limp and lifeless after wielding such potent energies. My head swam with vertigo, and only my right hand's grip on the shaft of the staff kept me from stumbling. My eyesight was filled with floaters as mage sight failed me, and I had to blink several times before I could focus on the dying thaumaturgical fire I'd set.
"Duin's greasy beard, my lord. What manner of spellwork was that?"
Barroso asked in awe, when he gained the rooftop ahead of his comrades. Everyone was concerned with my health after such a powerful display, and I'm certain the look on my face justified it. You just can't channel that much power without there being physical consequences.
"My own," I said, fighting dizziness. "A state secret. Something they've never seen before," I croaked, as I considered walking.
Then I reconsidered. Standing was hard enough. No need to complicate things.
"I've never seen the like,"
the war mage confessed.
"Even at Ulam Seheri, when I thought I'd seen every kind of magic, I never saw a display like that. The air was on fire at one point," he reported, as he slipped his arm underneath mine and led me over to a bench. "They had tough wards,"
I nodded. It was too difficult to explain further, I decided. I was pissed off about the castle. That may have coloured the spell.
"Hope I never piss you off," Barroso nodded reverently.
"A mighty effort, my count, one worthy of the attention of the gods," boomed Caswallon as he came up the ladder.
Timoniel was right behind him, looking anxious and concerned. Both showed signs of prolonged battle.
How many have been evacuated?"
I asked him, my voice hoarse.
"We've no report from the keep yet," Caswallon said, shaking his head, "but it would have to be hundreds by now. The wounded, at least. Shall we stay the evacuation?"
he asked, curious. Caswallon was always up to a fight to the last man, I noted.
"You have turned the day here, my count. Surely the spellmonger's wrath will stay the heart of any foe who dares contest him."
"There is chaos among the Gavani," Timoniel agreed. "With no one in command, it is unlikely that they will be able to mount an offence that will overwhelm this castle," he offered.
"I think they'd have a fighting chance,"
Barroso nodded.
"The infantry are shredded. The artillery are gone.
The siege worms are running amok. The Iron Band can hold, he assured.
I peered out over the wall at the devastation I'd wrought. There were casualties everywhere. Bodies littered the slope. Whatever advance they'd been performing was over, and the survivors were slinking back downhill as our archers continued to harass them. They were a disorganized mob now, not an army. But they were still dangerous, and our strategic position here was untenable.
No, I said softly, no. Continue the evacuation, I ordered, as I tried to catch my breath. If possible, get them out overland, but get them out. Fort Destiny is lost, I said, shaking my head as I glanced up over my shoulder at the cracked shell of the castle. But it is avenged. These men will be put to better use in other battles, not spending their lives pointlessly defending a ruined keep.
As you wish, Count Manillan, Barroso agreed, as he opened a waterskin and handed it to me. Sir Suston was wondering what your decision would be. He wishes a moment's counsel when you have a spare moment.
Let me catch my breath, I asked, as my head continued to swim. The water was warm, but I drank it gratefully. There was dust and bile in my throat. The echoes of the snowflake's power were still ringing in my brain. The smell of ozone was in the air. A flicker of shadow made me glance up, allowing me to see the Skyriders beginning a third sortie against the survivors of the Gavanni army below.
I think we're almost done here. But whether we account this a victory or a defeat, I cannot say.
It might prove easier, Caswallon proposed, if we claimed victory over the Gavanni. They do not yet understand what has befallen their forces.
Or who? Timoniel agreed. To devastate an enemy without informing him of who has done so is ignoble to the Alka Alon, the Terra Alon warrior reported.
Well, I wouldn't want to be rude, I sighed, and activated my link to the megalith.
In a moment, a huge photomantic spell filled the sky with a massive black hammer. Three green major stars float around it in an equilateral triangle. Above that, rotating parallel to the ground, was a giant snowflake that gleamed in the afternoon light.
That should let them know, I sighed.
'Tis good meat and fit for a warrior to tout his victories, Caswallon agreed, nodding meaningfully.
One might mistake that for a bountiful ego, Barroso chuckled.
Ego, properly harnessed, can be a powerful weapon, I reminded him, purposefully not glancing at Caswallon. I wouldn't have been able to retaliate as I did without it.
And anger, I added softly. I truly did not realize how angry I am at Korbal and the Nemovorti until now.
Then they would be wise to quit the field and not annoy you, Caswallon agreed, for your righteous wrath has slain hundreds today and decimated the might of our foes. Such glory does not...
Yes, yes, Caswallon, I'm great and powerful and wonderful, I assured him. Let's talk at length about it later.
Right now, Sir Sastan, the commander of the Iron Band, is evacuating his destroyed headquarters and wants a word or two.
Let's not keep him waiting on account of my ego, shall we?
We did not return to Megalyn Castle until late in the evening, when only a few hundred stalwart Iron Band's men volunteers were left holding the remains of Fort Destiny. Their goal was not to die valiant in defense of a lost cause. They were there for nuisance value, an attempt to hold the attention of the rest of the Gavanni army as long as possible. They weren't worth much as a besieging force anymore, with their artillery destroyed and half of their siege beasts dead, not to mention the lack of a magical corps or even their commanders. But there were still several thousands of them, enough to reinforce one of the other divisions besieging one of our other castles. That was a potential danger. The longer they could be detained here, focused on their own lost cause, the better chance we'd have. The men who stayed behind were mostly veterans of the band and all were volunteers. Before we departed, we'd helped repair as much of the wall as possible and ensured that there was a sufficiency of supplies and arms to sustain them. Two of the band's war magi, one of them augmented with Irionite, elected to remain as well to supply intelligence and provide a means of escape through the ways, if all else was lost. I was hopeful of their chances. It was clear to the Gavanni, I think, that the enemy they came to attack had not perished, but it was much diminished now.
What was left of Fort Destiny was still tightly held from casual attack, but the big garrison they had come against was gone, and what was left could be evacuated within a matter of hours. Conquering Fort Destiny would still require a lengthy siege to succeed, and would result in no great victory for Shacathet. The mood in the war chamber at Megalyn was tense when we returned. I dismissed my men to eat and sleep before I sought out Telamon. If he had moved from the spot since I'd left for Fort Destiny, it didn't show, except that he'd found time to get a shave, somehow. The diorama was a grim display of our situation, and I tried to absorb it all with a few moments' study. Megalyn was being assailed by one of the larger forces, I could see, though Forgemont and Iron Hill were attracting the Gavanni-like iron filings to lodestones. Each of the three castles was growing a ring of Corbel's minions around it. Several other divisions of the Horde were pushing through the spaces between, toward other targets. It still wasn't clear where they were going, save eastward, but they weren't wandering aimlessly. "I saw what you did at Destiny," Telamon mentioned, while I studied the map. "Good work. We've got most of the band's men billeted here and at Forgemont at the moment. That's likely where you'll want to move next," he decided, as if I hadn't spent the day in a mentally exhausting and physically punishing struggle. "I might want a nap," I muttered. "Take one," he shrugged. "Forgemont's got better defensive geography than Fort Destiny. It's harder to set up a good artillery battery there. They'll probably last until morning," he guessed. "Iron Hill's getting hit harder, but they have better defences." "And Megalyn?" I asked, as I examined the tiny castle on the diorama that represented the massive keep in which I was standing. "How dire are things here?" "Not so bad yet," he decided matter-of-factly. "Azar is harassing the artillery and challenging the pickets on their flanks. He's attacking their outposts and patrols, but he doesn't quite have enough force to do more than irritate them, alas. They've tried two futile attempts to gain the walls with ladders, but they were laughable." "That just means the enshadowed sorcerers haven't arrived yet," I predicted. "They're good. They cracked Destiny's keep like an egg. Let's hope they don't repeat the trick when they arrive. They are just now setting up their defensive wards on their encampment, without realizing that we've seeded the battlefield with magical constructs. When they are rested, I plan to have the Skyriders pay them a visit to further distract them," Tell said, with a satisfied smirk. "How are their numbers here?" I asked, as I examined the model. I was afraid to hear the answer. "Nearly 18,000, three-quarters of it are infantry," Terlaman answered. "But at this point, their numbers aren't much of an advantage. They keep getting in one another's way." "What is your plan?" I asked, curious. "Endure the siege for as long as possible and hope they make a mistake I can capitalize on," Telamon said confidently. I raised my eyebrows in surprise. "You think they'll make a mistake? It's inescapable," he dismissed. "I just have to recognize it as such and be in a position to act. Shacathet himself directs the battle here," he added. "He might have a reputation as a military genius, but he's as prone to mistakes as any commander. They're inevitable when commanding an army that size, spread out over that wide of an area. Against a superior commander," he added with the slightest of grins, "it's not a matter if things will go wrong, it's how. Happens to every commander." "Which begs the question, what has gone wrong for your command?" I inquired. "I just lost a castle I'd planned on holding," he answered at once, "and one of my most important field commanders just lost his temper and used magic on the battlefield he probably shouldn't have," he reminded me. "Oh," I sighed, "that. You were the one who told me that using that thing would be the surest way to attract attention from the sea folk. As such, I had removed it from my considerations for battle. Yet access to such a powerful force could be important, even instrumental. If we want to win, that is," he added. "And now you've gone and done the one thing you told me we shouldn't do." "We still shouldn't do it," I agreed. "It was a mistake for me to do so at Destiny. But you did, and you will likely do so again. If the effect is as great as this time, it could be a pivotal fact of the battle, which could culminate with a lot of angry fishfolk appearing out of nowhere and demanding we get out of their world, because turning the shade of their distant but honored ancestor into a weapon for one of our little wars is rude, I argued. What do we do then? Blame it on the Alka alone, he suggested. I'm sure it's their fault anyway. Yes, I'm sure it is. But it would be dishonorable to say so, I chuckled. Not that I think the Vundel would believe it, or care. If they were that pissed off. That reminds me of something I thought of the other night, Turlamund said suddenly. I was thinking about what would make the Alka Alon come to this world when they knew it was ultimately doomed. They must have known that, he argued. I believe they did, I nodded. What of it? Why would they come here if they didn't think they could fix the... whatever it is? Or if they didn't think they could leave in a few generations, he proposed. I don't know. I'll ask next time I have one pinned down and drunk. I thought about Turlamund's question for a moment, though, as it was a thoughtful and insightful one. One doesn't move into a hall which is on fire, or likely to catch fire. It didn't sound as if they had a good idea how to fix it, if the Vundel couldn't. So, well, I suppose they were just planning on dying, I suggested hesitantly. Does that sound like the Alka Alon we know? He asked skeptically. Not in the slightest, I agreed with a sigh. Either they had a plan to fix it, or they had a plan to escape. Either way, we're screwed like a love sister on market day, he snorted, and they have a plan. We need to know that plan, to know what kind of allies we have. I can't argue, I nodded as I took a seat. I was suddenly tired to the bone. That's the problem. I can't argue with them. I don't know enough about even our closest friends among them to know what questions to ask, and I likely wouldn't understand the answers. Then you should put your arcanist on it, he suggested, after a few quiet moments that I was starting to enjoy. If anyone could discover the motivations of the Alka Alon through measuring their footprints or their taste in art, it's Heath. I concur, I nodded. Indeed, he's working on it, in a way. But it would certainly save some time if the Alka Alon would just tell us. It would be helpful to know just what kind of future we were facing. I began to answer, but was interrupted by a sudden yawn. Mine includes an early morning foray to Forgemont, I pointed out, and I'll try to avoid using any more forbidden magic. But first, I need sleep and food. But mostly sleep. I decided, stretching, as long and as deep as possible. Chapter 21. Landric's Plan. No matter how subtle the wizard, a knife in the back will ruin his day. Magelore Folksaying, from the collection of Jannik the Rhys. Determined bastards, aren't they? Wenwick said casually, as a storm of magical fire was flung from the gloomy battlefield below. It got caught in the castle's wards, but transformed into a caustic liquid instead of just dissipating politely. Some of the substance splashed down on the Gavani below, as well as the defenders, causing both sides to scream and howl in agony as their clothes or fur was eaten away. As the pre-dawn gloom began to lighten, you could almost make out the victims without mage sight. The rotund war mage looked fairly determined himself in his heavy armor of dragon-scale breastplate. Wenwick's new Ealtadine steel helmet was already scratched and battered from the assault, telling me how hot the battle had been in the last few hours. A thick grey woolen mantle hung from his shoulders, shrouding him in the shadows as he watched a storming party of hobgoblins try to set a ladder against the outer wall, over the moat and between the turrets. With a wave of his battle staff, they were bashed by a wall of magical force and flung into the ditch below. They just keep coming, he said with grim cheerfulness. They come, and me and the lads knock them down. We'd arrived at Forgemont by means of the ways just an hour before dawn, the goblins' preferred time of attack. Despite formerly being the seat of a baron, Forgemont was a much smaller castle than Fort Destiny and more lightly manned. There was an army of more than 5,000 Gavani encamped at the bottom of the steep, winding, switch-backed incline
that was the only road up to the remote castle. Winnick had called me mind to mind, and suggested that things would be hotter on the wall in the sunlight than it had been all night. When we came through, Baron Winnick himself met us with a half dozen of his Pearwood lads. "How are they doing at siege work?" I asked, after introducing my new strike team to him. "I wouldn't think that they'd like this kind of fight." "The Pearwoods have no real castle," he pointed out, as we walked up the stairs of a turret overlooking the gate. "The lads aren't used to fighting behind walls, but they're quickly picking up the art," he said proudly, gesturing to a line of Pearwoods archers who were determinedly picking off Gavanni below, while others cast stones with fair precision. "They've learned that thick walls and height advantage aren't so bad after all. The lads who were with me at Spellgate this winter are helping out the rest," he added, as we made the top. "Those idiots keep sending sortie after sortie of scrugs against the gatehouse, but they have little to show for it but corpses. How did things fare at Fort Destiny?" he asked, cocking an eyebrow as he changed the subject. "We heard the spellmonger was there." "He was," Astral agreed, as he took a position between two crenels and surveyed the battlefield. "He lost his temper there. The battle was won. The castle, alas, was lost." That was as good a way of putting it as any, I decided. Perhaps a more charitable assessment than I'd give, but then Astral was a bit of an optimist. "There's a skeleton crew of 300 holding what's left," I agreed somberly. "We evacuated nearly 1,500 to Megalyn, but Destiny has all but fallen. The castle won't be much use to anyone in the future. But then neither will the Gavanni army." "You lost your temper?" Winnick asked, amused. I got frustrated. I used some questionable combat magic," I explained, without elaborating. "When the Enshadowed destroyed the keep, Min got testy and blasted, well, everything," Landric reported. "The Skyriders were also a boon to the battle. And we did a bit," he added with a shrug. "Great was the suffering amongst the foe when the spellmonger's fell hand wielded his forceful craft," Caswallon assured, solemnly. "I've never seen such potent action, not even in Ulam Seheri."
"That's a place you shouldn't mention lightly around my lads," Winnick cautioned in a low voice, cutting his eyes back and forth to see if we'd been overheard. "There are a lot of bad stories floating around the Pearwoods about that place. A couple of my lads came back hurt. Badly."
Winnick's lads weren't just the run-of-the-market Pearwoods clan warriors. He'd made a point of attracting as many war magi to the rough wilderness he ruled, using bribery and the charms of the Pearwoods maidens as a lure. He'd cultivated a cenacle of them, nearly a dozen, who specialized in the brutal kind of war magic my fat friend enjoyed. Anything that caused pain and misery was of interest to Winnick, and he passed along a repertoire of magical misery to his apprentices and allies. Most of his makeshift magical corps had adopted the simple dress of the Pearwoods clans during their association, and often they were indistinguishable from the average tribal warrior, save that their sticks didn't have spearheads at the end of them. They didn't look any happier about the continuous line of Gavanni marching up the hill against them than their mundane fellows.
"They seem to be doing an adequate job regardless," Astral commented, gesturing to a growing pile of bodies in front of the gatehouse.
"I'm surprised that we're not taking more conventional artillery fire, though." "Oh, we took care of most of their engines before they arrived," Winnick assured. "One of the lads got them stuck in the mud, about a mile and a half up the road, while another band raided them. They've maybe 2-3 mangonels left," he said proudly.
"But a goodly supply of sorcerers and shamans to make up for it," Master Cormoran said as he arrived up the stairs. The master weaponsmith was wearing the finest Iltadine armor, including a far more forbidding helmet than Wenick's simple steel pot. Cormoran leaned on his heavy battle staff as he regarded us tiredly. "I've been defending against their arcane attacks since dusk."
"We all have," Wenick agreed, nodding grimly. "I don't know where they got these new song spellers."
"That's spell singers," corrected Timoniel politely, "and they aren't. The Enshadowed are using ancient Alka-Alon war magic," he explained apologetically. "That's quite different from what we use. They're using forbidden sorcery. It's a different system of magic entirely.
Nary a merry tune is used in their casting, he assured in his bell-like voice. Nor is it like human war magic in composition or deployment. Aye, that would explain it, sighed Komoran heavily. Their spells chafe at my wards like they were an annoyance. Some they ignore completely and are unaffected. The arcane sorties they have led have killed a former apprentice of mine, Daris of Dorcris, during the initial wave of assault. The man I placed in charge here, he said, shaking his head sadly. That's why I came to see to the defense personally. Things picked up when everyone saw you were in charge, my lord, Wenwick assured the smith. Nothing is going to break this castle. Aye, Caswallon interjected suddenly. Forgemont will be the anvil on which the Gavanni break, he assured. All that is needed is the heat of true battle to blaze our glory red hot, and then will fall the blows that will transform it into legend. Komoran winced at the tortured metaphor, but he was used to Caswallon's vain glory enough to ignore it. They scouted us well enough to know what our weaknesses are, Komoran said, walking past Caswallon to stare at the army in the distance. See, they spare their siege worms the torturous path where they could be trapped in ambush, and sent wave after wave of Gavani's sappers against us instead. While we muddle against the sorties against our gate, they spend their time digging a shaft to undermine our gates. Are they not protected? Barroso asked, concerned. Aye, Komoran agreed reluctantly. Mage Lord Camilla herself constructed the spells to shield them from the usual spells. But they're using unusual spells, and making far more progress than I would wish. A tunnel, I said with a sigh. They did that at Boval Castle, too. It doesn't run adjacent to a seam of coal, does it? I asked with interest. No, Komoran said, shaking his head. Mere dirt and rocks. But they are making lamentably fast progress. Their shaft has already grown to almost 100 feet since they began, and they are but 150 feet from our outer towers. If they should topple one, they will gain the walls without challenging the gate. Then why do they keep challenging the gate? Wenwick asked, irritated. We've been defending it all night, and every time we throw down one party, they send another 15 minutes later. Distraction, Timonio proposed, as he leaned over the battlement to study the enemy's movements. If you are fighting at the gate, you aren't paying attention elsewhere. The hell we aren't, Komoran grumbled in the darkness. I've 3 wizards watching everything they're doing, from all sides. And below, he insisted sourly. But why a tunnel? Timonial asked insistently. Because if they make it all the way to the towers on the wall, they can dig out beneath it until it falls. Do you tree folk not practice siege warfare? Wenwick asked, surprised. Our historical strategies emphasize victory on the open field, not in a protracted siege, Timonial conceded after a moment's thought. Our cities were not designed for war. Our citadels were garrisons and headquarters, not true fortresses. Yet the Enshadowed seem eager to adapt to the Humani way of warfare, I pointed out, or at least the Gavanni do. They have been fighting your people a lot longer than mine have, Timonial said, apologetically. The Enshadowed are mired in the old ways of war. The Gavanni are more adaptable, and they do dig better than we do, he conceded. They were designed that way. Yes, that was smart, Astaroth said sarcastically. They were also designed to fight at night. That was also smart. They were not designed to fight at all, Timonial insisted. They were to be servile, helpful. They perform their duties at night while the rest of our society sleeps. It wasn't until the Enshadowed fell short of establishing a consensus and pressed them to service as soldiery that they took up weapons, he said defensively. As fascinating as this historical lesson is, my lord, Landric said dourly, your former servants seem determined to employ their strategies toward our ruin if we do not counter them. Pray tell me you have a plan, Menelan, he said urgently. Perhaps once I've seen where they are and where they are headed, I offered. In my experience, Gavanni siege craft has been crude but effective. The direction of the Enshadowed has given them little advantage in the art so far. until one of their ancient sorceries destroys a wall or a tower or a keep, Wenek snorted, shaking his head. I've been fighting Scrug shamans for years. I know how to do that. These sorcerous buggers are different. I don't even know what to properly defend against since this war began. Alas, against the ancient sorcery of the Enshadowed, none of us know, Tamanil said sadly. While the rest of my people have all but forgotten the spells of that bloody age, they have been practicing them in secret. I would have been shamed into silence by my parents if they knew I'd studied such things. So, they didn't know? Wenek asked the Terra Alon pointedly. I mean, you did study those forgotten spells, didn't you? He asked, as another blast erupted near the gatehouse. I've ever been drawn to the forgotten and forbidden lore, confessed Tamanil, with a mixture of guilt and pride. The spells of war and destruction seemed a tantalizing achievement for a rebellious son of a once great house such as me. But the few spells that survived the aftermath of my sire's struggles are paltry compared to what was hidden away long before I was born. A pity that, grunted Wenek. We could use a good counter to that, he said, as another wave of sorcery erupted overhead. This time the arcane energy came in a whirling spiral of destructive power. Once again, Forgemont's wards absorbed or transformed a great deal of it. Once again, the residual effects shook the castle and knocked dozens of men to their knees. A few in the proximity of the blast screamed and clutched at their heads as the wave of power shattered bones and scrambled brains. Bagger me with a butter churn. Those are multispectral waveforms with a higher register, Wenek declared. I've used them myself, but never at that level of power, even with Irionite. It would cook my brain in my skull if I tried, he assured us. Most of what you would consider Alka-Alon war magic isn't so messy, Tamanil frowned. It tends to be more precise and deliberate. My people dislike hitting targets that they're not aiming at. But like their penchant for necromancy, the Enshadow don't seem to value precision over power. That's interesting, Landrick said, his eyes narrowing as he gazed out over the field. Unlike at Fort Destiny, the enemy encampment wasn't visible from the castle. There were too many ridges and curves in the road. Does someone have a mage map of the battlefield? He asked. Of course, Camoran said, and with a wave of his hand he produced a visible representation of the mountain fort and surroundings in the air in front of him. We all gathered around, considering the positions of attackers and defenders. This was accurate as of a half hour ago. My lords, sharp-eyed Tamanil interrupted, pointing down the road. I believe our foe is sending forth his herald. We turned to see a cluster of Alka-Alon in their ancient warrior forms, pushing their way through the mass of Gavani, who were braving the rain of arrows along the twisting road. They were taller and more elegant than their furry soldiers, but no less fearsome to behold. Their angular bodies and sharp features lacked the elements of humanity the Terra Alon had included in their larger forms, and they bore long brown cloaks over their steel armor, clearly of Dradrian manufacture. Each bore a long bow and a spear, as well as knives and wands and other weaponry. While the Enshadowed were bareheaded, their leader wore a helm that seemed ornamented from a distance, more crown than war helmet, I noted to myself. He carried a great white staff or pole that rose 2 feet above his head. At its tip was a golden sphere. Mage sight revealed how it crackled with sorcery.
That's no mere herald. That's Drathmund,
Tamanil said excitedly as he recognized the Alcan.
I am unfamiliar with the gentleman,
Camoran said, unimpressed.
Gentleman might not be the proper word, as I understand the term, the Terra Alon War Mage admitted. Drathmund was a quiet supporter of the Enshadowed until their exile, Tamanil explained. Then he seemed to forswear his allegiance to them and made peace with the Alka-Alon Council eventually. Some had even forgotten his old alliance. He was considered a historian and scholar of some renown, but then he disappeared a century ago, I believe, and hasn't been seen since. No one has reported his reappearance with the Enshadowed, he frowned.
Drathmund was on a list we recently received, I recalled, from my conversation with the spy from the Westlands. He was considered a challenger to Shakathet. A poor one, I remembered.
As a war leader, that's probably accurate, agreed Timoniel. He was never particularly militant, from what I understand. But the enshadowed reward loyalty. This posting was likely his due in return for his quiet service all of those years. That doesn't mean that he's good at it. He probably relies on the expertise of his subordinates. So does Menelan, Astaroth quipped. I hope that doesn't reflect poorly on your leadership, he added with a smirk. Even a bad leader has a chance when he leads an army that large, Landrick said. And a good one can prevail leading an army much smaller, Cormoran insisted. Count Menelan, with your permission, let us go hear this embassy. Archers! Cease fire! He bellowed, and the call was quickly echoed across the walls and turrets. Incoming fire from the attackers also ceased. Agreed, I nodded. Caswallon, stay here to command the reserve war magi, while we parley, I ordered. The last thing I needed in the middle of a delicate negotiation was an indelicate war mage. It shall be the honor of the fox to prepare the mightiest arcane vengeance on those miserable, unfaithful creatures, spellmonger, if their pledged truce cannot be trusted, Caswallon said, clearly believing it would be. It would be a disgrace for him to break it, Timoniel assured. He would lose the consensus of his fellows. No danger can accrue to an emissary. Unless you feel like challenging him to a duel, you are safe to hear him speak. Duel? Barroso asked, suddenly intrigued. That's allowed. During the old wars, it was sometimes done, Timoniel shrugged, as we began walking toward the gatehouse stairs. If two members of the delegations were at odds and challenged each other, they could settle their differences at arms before the actual battle began. I do recall that from the epics, Astaroth agreed. The Anshinal Rusara has a passage detailing that, I believe. Ah, smiled Timoniel. You are a scholar, Baron Astaroth. Yes. Belenath challenged Tarmael and slew him before the attack on Althinsarel. They fought with spears, magic, and then daggers, surrounded by their armies. It was a glorious duel, it is said. It went on for 30 stanzas, Astaroth agreed. A bit floridly, perhaps, but interesting, he said, as we waited for the guards to open the postern door for us. The Gavani had backed up out of bowshot for the duration of the truce. The enshadowed delegation appeared to be what I was starting to consider the normal sort of collection for what was becoming a common occurrence. Human lords often sent emissaries and heralds to discuss a truce, usually to discuss terms or to tend to the wounded, but it was a far less formalized affair for us than the immortals. The Alka Alon seemed to delight in telling us just who was going to try to kill us. The ritual was part of the humiliation of defeat for them. A victory wasn't a victory to the Alka Alon unless the loser was aware of who beat them. I didn't mind the rite. It had proven useful against Gajakatar, but I didn't agree with the philosophy behind it. I didn't need my enemies to know who was responsible for their defeat. I preferred just to win. Drathmond and his lackeys stood under a teardrop-shaped mage light of pale blue, with quiet patience in the misty gloom of twilight as we approached. Around them, their Gavani auxiliaries watched, weapons in hand, apparently grateful for the break in the fighting. Menelan, would you allow me to take charge? Cormoran asked quietly as we neared. Forgemont is my castle, after all. As long as you don't surrender it out of hand, certainly, I nodded, earning a smirk of amusement from the weaponsmith. Who comes before Captain Drathmond to hear his words and beg for their lives? Asked the enshadowed herald haughtily. I'll hear his words, Cormoran replied evenly as he leaned on his battle staff. We'll see who ends up begging for their lives. I am Mage Lord Cormoran, Lord of Forgemont. As such, I invite you to quit your aggression, withdraw your troops, and return to the penumbra.
It would be a poor use of my master's resources to march all this way and fail to achieve our mission, Drathmond announced, a sneer evident in his voice. I have been tasked with scouring the Humani settlements from the land, a policy long overdue, he added with a sneer. Too long have we endured the stain of your presence in our lands. As amusing as you creatures are, our tolerance of your presence is at an end.
Korbal has declared that all indulgences of your race are over. You will be removed, he said, with a special intensity. You will find that difficult, Komoran said harshly, in a voice hoarse from countless hours in the smoke of his forge. Do you think we are unprepared for this, Drathmond? Learn the term Iltadin steel, he advised, slowly drawing his sword. It was a new mage blade, one I'd never seen before, elegant and deadly in form. For it shall be the swords, forged in Iltadin, that you will impale yourselves upon. He's as bad as Caswallon, complained Astaroth, mind to mind. He's just worked up because this is his castle, and this is the first chance he's had to show off his new toy. Komoran can be a little dramatic when it comes to his steel, I reminded him. He's a proud man. Drathmond laughed at the sight of the mage blade. You are vastly outnumbered, besieged, and soon to be overwhelmed. Your panoply will make no difference. Behold my sword, Forge's Fury, made by Master Su He of the Dradrian, Komoran revealed, his eyes blazing. It is made of Anakurkas, designed to destroy the enneagram of any Nemavorti it slays, but I suppose it will work on Elka Alon as well, he said, as he sheathed the blade. What have you to match that? And my Irionite, he challenged. Drathmond snorted with undisguised derision. You have a magic sword, and a shard of raw, impure Irionite you stole from a Gavanni shaman. I have 9 adepts of the highest ability, each with an orb.